Well, along with Dan Kuhn, Ron Miscavige is the author of Ruthless Scientology, My Son David Miscavige, and Me. And pretty much this is the only book to examine the origins of Scientology's current leader. It's a very revealing story of David Miscavige's childhood, his path, the head seat of the Church of Scientology, as seen through the eyes of his father, Ron Miscavige. Of course, David, the successor to founder L. Ron Hubbard, hasn't always ruled with an iron fist, according to his dad, Ron, who first introduced his family to Scientology. As a young boy, David embraced it immediately. Years later, Ron could only watch with dismay as his bright, carefree son transformed into the leader he is today. Ruthless, the name of the book, explores the Miscavige family's gradual immersion into the church and the seeds that were planted for David's meteoric ascendancy. Ron traces the arc of David's life from the early years to David's stellar rise to power in Scientology, his brutal approach at running the organization today, and the disastrous effects that his leadership has had on countless numbers of Scientologists and their families. Ron Miscavige is the father, of course, of David Miscavige, the leader of Scientology, and he joins us today. Listen, you have just done so much media. You must be exhausted from being grilled with all these questions.
Let me tell you something. It is tiring at times. I'm fine now because, I don't know, I feel that I have a kind of a mission with this book to expose how the church has transformed from what I thought was a very nice self-help group back in the late 60s, early 70s, where when you walked through the doors of an organization, you did get data about life, and you did courses and did exercises that you could go out and demonstrate them in your daily life and become more able and more effective at dealing with life itself and interpersonal relationships. It's changed. It's done, as far as I'm concerned, a 180 from those days to where today the main thrust of the church is buying up real estate so they could claim that they're expanding, and because they buy more buildings and turn them into the churches. And of course, there's not people in them, there's air. So that it went from what it was in the 70s to what it is now. And what happened to me, I don't think should happen to anybody. And no, that's the disconnection policy. I guess we're going to get into that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, listen, I just want to let you know that Dr. James Beverly is a world religions expert. I believe you and he have maybe shared some emails, but he has helped me arrange interviews over the years with Amy Scobie, Spanky Taylor, Chris Shelton, Hannah Etrigham Whitfield, Tony Christman, Tony Ortega, Paulette Cooper, Laurie Hodgson, Jeff Hawkins, even Jamie DeWolf, great-grandson of LRH, and the president of Scientology Canada, Yvette Shank. And so we have really delved into this whole thing a lot over the years. But of course, you're the daddy of the man, and ain't nobody getting to the man. I mean, he shut down doing interviews a while ago, and I guess that helps to create the mystique. And you're the next best thing. And of course, being a defector, it's not just leaving the thing that is fascinating for people. It's the relationship dynamics. I mean, this is your boy, right? This is the boy that you took to the doctors because he had wicked asthma.
Yes. I mean, really terrible asthma.
Right.
And he was afflicted with this right at birth. I mean, as a little baby, sometimes he would turn blue. I mean, it used to scare the devil out of me. And I'm the one who would take him to the doctor to get him shots of adrenaline, which I never thought they were good for a little kid. And I was always on the search for things that I could use to help him get through this and to try various. I mean, at one point, and of course I tell about it, all this in the book, but one instant was he, and it was getting on to the wintertime, had an attack, and he started turning blue, and he was not coming off it. He could not let that breath out of his lungs. So just as a wild idea I had, I took him upstairs to the bathroom, took off all of my clothes, all of his clothes, went in the shower with him with the warm water. This is the wintertime now.
Yeah.
And I says, okay, Dave, I'm going to turn the hot water off. And I didn't want him to think I was punishing him. That's why I went in the shower with him.
Yeah.
And I turned the hot water off, and we were blasted with cold water that forced him to start breathing in and out. And I dried him off with a Turkish towel, gave him a kiss, and he was handled for the moment. Wow. I mean, these are the type of things I would try with him.
Wow. Okay, so, you know, let's start going back to the basic questions. You know, everybody as an outsider wants to know why you joined, why did you leave? You know, was it a slow burn getting out? Was there a final straw? So let's get into why you joined in the first place. And as I understand it, you first heard about Scientology at a business meeting.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was involved in a multi-marketing scheme called Holiday Magic. It's similar to Amway, or I'm sure you've known about various multi-marketing ideas.
Yeah.
Anyway, this had to do with cosmetics. And we were having what's called an opportunity meeting in a motel called the Mallard in South Jersey. And I'm talking to a person in front of me, and my partner in those days was this girl next to me. She was talking to a guy, and he said to her, "I'm a Scientologist." And I said to the fellow I was talking to, I said, "Excuse me a minute." I said, "What is that?" For some reason, that name rang a bell, and I don't know why, but I pinned him down, and I made him tell me about this for a good half an hour. And one of the things he said was, "Listen, if you become a Scientologist, you don't have to take another aspirin." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" So he gave me a little exercise to do, and I said, "Well, I don't have a headache now, but you know, I'll try it sometime." So I was driving in South Jersey maybe a week later, had a headache, tried this, and the headache went away instantly. And by the way, I tell this exercise in the book.
Wait, is this where you rub the muscle in between your thumb and your index finger? I do that once in a while.
Nope, this is totally different, and I'd rather people read about it, because this way they're getting exactly how it came about. It went away, and I thought at that moment, hey, this is something, I got to check this out. And of course, I always had in the back of my mind, how am I going to handle David's asthma? Because it was killing him as a little kid.
Yeah,
he was like a little firecracker. He played Little League football, baseball. But boy, when these attacks had come on, I just felt helpless. I didn't know what to do. So anyway, that's how we got started. With that, I said, listen, there was a place in South Jersey run by Frank Ogle. He had a cafeteria, and every Tuesday or Wednesday, he'd have a meeting and tell people about various things in Scientology, and you could try these out. So after about a month, I figured, okay, I'm going to use these. They were good. And then David's attacks just kept on going. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to take him down to see Frank Ogle and have him see if he can help him with what is called auditing. It's basically counseling, but it's not like any counseling you'd get, you know, in the world at large. This is a specific way to handle a person with communication. So I took him down and I said, "Frank, do you think you could handle this?" He took David in session, and about 45 minutes later, he came out smiling, cheery. I said, "Hey, how's it going, kid?" He said, "Dad," he says, "my asthma's gone." Now, I'm going to tell you something. It wasn't gone, but it definitely mitigated it, because he'd get attacks later, but never as severe. Yeah. That was it. And as far as I'm concerned, that was David's epiphany. And that, I think, led him to his goal in life of, I've got to do something in Scientology.
Right, okay.
So he was 9 years old.
So really, it helped David's asthma and gave him sort of a little bit of a boost in life. Probably helps confidence as well as a young kid. And it helped you in sales, I can imagine. So there was a real practical aspect to buying into Scientology. True?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you this. I think it's just built in to mankind to help. Look, I feed the birds. You know, I want to help them.
Yeah.
They can buy chipmunks, rabbits, squirrels, and there were two ducks eating bird seed in our yard the other day. So when you find something that helps you, you think to yourself, man, you know, I should get other people into this. And so there's a naturally tendency to recruit others into the religion itself. And I think that's why it expanded, because in those days, you were learning things that you could apply in life that helped you, and you wanted everybody to know about this, Drew.
The investment in something. You know, when somebody invests in a marriage for 27 years or 25, you know, whatever. When somebody invests in a friendship, when somebody invests in a work scheme or a job or a company, and then something happens and it goes south. I mean, that's a kick in the guts. It's a real kick in the soul. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, this is kind of what happened to you, but was it a slow burn? Was it, you know, that one straw that broke the camel's back? Was there a moment? And then, of course, you know, everyone's forgetting it. It's not just, oh, I got bugged at Scientology and I left and now everything's peachy. I would imagine there would still be a grieving process. I think I just asked you 17 questions at one time, so sorry about that.
No, that's okay. No, I'm here. I'm willing to talk about it.
All right.
And if I can approach this with one idea in mind, and that is this, that there was not a single moment where I said, the heck with this, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Because what happens as you go forward in Scientology, you gain confidence in the data and information about life a little bit at a time. You find out there's a way, a proper communication formula, and you examine this, you apply it to life. Man, this works. Now, that is solid data that you can use on an everyday basis. There's then information about a better relationship with another person. You adopt this, you see how it works, and that works. So you're going along on a concatenation of certainties. I wanted to use that big word.
Ooh, you know, I love that. That's good.
It's like a little bit at a time. You're getting all these certainties. And so now you then, as you proceed, may be given information or data that isn't quite making sense to you, but you rely on the fact that in the past you had this that was true, you had that that was true, you had another thing, and you say to yourself, well, this is probably true because all the other things were true, and you accept it. Now, that then leads you into going into an area of Scientology where things are promised that can't be delivered, such as a person who leaves his body as a spiritual being and operates totally without any mechanical means to, let's say you were here in Canada and you went to Germany and read a newspaper, or you would be able to go with full perception to other places. I don't know of one person who ever achieved that in Scientology, yet that's on the upper level of the bridge. But because you received all these certainties prior to that, when you get there, you think, well, maybe it's me. Maybe it's going to be the next level. And this is what keeps people coming back for more. But if you start looking at it, and it's a hard thing to swallow, you say, hey, you know what? Maybe things aren't totally what they say they are.
Yeah.
And then you start examining it. And if you start looking on the internet and seeing information that is factual, you then start losing you're not losing certainty. You're gaining certainty on the fact that what you suspected is probably true.
Yeah.
And that's the process of getting in and also getting out. But listen, Groot, I was a member of the church for 42 years, and I was in the C organization for 26 and a half. So this is not one little thing that got me aggravated or irritated with them, and I said, the heck with it, I'm leaving. You see that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do. I do.
Did I answer your question?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but as you're answering that, Ron, it sounds to me like you still dig Scientology, the Scientology that you hoped it would be, the Scientology that you signed up for originally.
Okay, then let me clarify that. I will tell you there are various aspects of it that absolutely work.
Yeah.
But there are aspects of it that completely are false and can't be delivered.
Okay, so is there not a group of sort of reorganized Scientologists who want to get back to the roots and are trying to get rid of the wacky stuff?
There are independent practitioners of Scientology.
Right.
And these practitioners will give you the Scientology that I knew, even the things of the upper levels that, as far as I'm concerned, that promise has never been delivered.
Right.
But they will deliver services to you, and you get out of it what you want to get out of it, is what it is.
Yeah.
But the price is so far less than what you'd pay if you went to an organization. It's ridiculous. In order to get these upper levels in Scientology, you're going to spend maybe in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Man.
Whereas you go to an independent practitioner, you're talking way, way, way less than that. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you what I did. When I got out and I escaped on March 25th of 2012, I started researching an area of about 1850 till early 1900s of movement that went on in the United States, and start reading these authors. And I was flabbergasted to realize that some of the things they said were exactly what L. Ron Hubbard was saying, except there was no agenda. All they wanted to do was sell books, get the data out to people, and have people improve their lives. Whereas if you get into Scientology, it's more than just that. This is a power movement that's going on.
Yeah.
But anyway, I give reference to these in the book itself. And if you were a Scientologist and you start reading this, you're going to say, good Lord, this is what L. Ron Hubbard said. But he said he got his data from studying Freud, Thomas Bacon, you know, a lot of these philosophers. I don't believe that. I think he almost cut and pasted it out of that early era of that movement that went on between about 1850 and early 1900s, and then he added his own agenda to it.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are saying the same thing. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about March 25th, 2012. That's the day of escape, and and this I want to start this part of the conversation by being a bit of a jerk. When I did the research on you, of course, I know Scientology enough to know that they are going to have a fantastic anti-you campaign. They're going to have a smear campaign against Ron Miscavige. And of course, I go to one of their sites because I don't know you. Now I did ask a couple of people who have read your book and who are in the inside, and they say everything you've said correlates with everybody else who's gotten out. So, you know, it's not just a, some people may think you're just trying to make a buck, right? Your enemies out there may say that. So I went to one of the Scientology websites that is a smear campaign on you. And I watched this video called The Great Escape. You know what I'm talking about, right? Have you seen it?
No.
Okay. So it's...
Let me tell you, Drew, before you go any further.
Yeah.
I look at what they're doing about the equivalent if I were walking down the street and there was a bulldog and he happened to start barking at me. I would not stop and try to argue with him. I just walk by the dog, and that's how I look at the church right now.
I agree. Look, let's just talk about smear campaign for a second. If you're going to put thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars into buying up domains and putting out all this smear campaign against you, I mean, come on. If they want to be called a legitimate church, if they really want to earn their tax-free status or their nonprofit status or whatever that they celebrated a while back, you think the money could be spent a little better.
You'd think the money might be spent giving some people who are down and out some food or maybe some training to get a job, just like the rescue mission that I support. Well, I don't support it totally, but I donate to it every month.
Sure.
They take people off the street who are street people who are broken, and they feed them, but they also teach them how to work, and then they help them go out and get a job. That's what I like to support. The church does nothing like that.
Nice.
But let me just back up on one thing that you said, these domains.
Yeah.
They bought over 500 iterations or variations of my name, Ron Miscavige. Over 500. Mm. So that no matter what you put in there, it would take you to their site.
Yeah.
Now, they also have policy that they operate on. And if you want, I can actually email these to you. But I'm going to quote some of them, if you don't mind, Drew. Okay?
Sure, why not?
Yeah. Now, here's one. It's called The Scientologist, and it was written around 1985, the magazine of Dianetics and Scientology from Phoenix, Arizona. Okay, now, we copied this out of a book, and on page 157, next to the last paragraph down, it said, the law can be used very easily to harass and enough harassment on somebody who is simply on the thin edge anyway, well knowing that he is not authorized, will generally be sufficient to cause his professional decease. And here's the kicker. If possible, of course, ruin him utterly.
Yeah.
That's one. Now, there's another one called HCO Policy Letter. And by the way, these are all titled HCO, Hubbard Communications Office Policy Letter, 15 August 1960, and it's called Department of Government Affairs. On the second page, it's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8th paragraph down. It says, always find or manufacture enough threat against them to cause them to sue for peace. Let me repeat that. Always find or manufacture. Hmm. Okay?
Okay, got it. Got it.
There's one more that I got to tell you because this is, you got to know this stuff. This is called Penalties for Lower Conditions. And this is a policy letter of 18 October 1967. And it's in under the condition of enemy, you'd be considered fair game. And here's what it says. may be deprived of property or injured by any means by any Scientologist without any discipline of the Scientologist, may be tricked, sued, or lied to, or destroyed.
Now, has the fair game policy been adjusted after L. Ron Hubbard's death?
I don't know that it has been adjusted, but I know this. It is in force from my own experience.
Okay.
Listen, my friend, I had guys following me in a car, two PIs being paid $10,000 a week to report my movements from 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night.
Now, are these the same guys that that thought you were having a heart attack when you were trying to catch the phone out of your shirt pocket and somebody named David on the phone said, just let it be?
Exactly. Well, specifically what was said was this, and you can look at Tony Ortega's site and hear these interviews, and it was Daniel Powell that told us. It's in about 30 minutes of his interview with the police. This is police records. This is not something that somebody recorded to play on the internet.
Yeah.
He said that it looked like the target was having a heart attack. They referred to me as a target. And listen, Drew, in the trunk, when the Dwayne Powell was arrested, they found five handguns, five license plates from different states, an 18 caliber rifle, a stun gun, a 22 caliber assault rifle with a silencer fixed to it. And they used to refer to me as the target.
Yeesh.
I know. Now, listen, I'm in a grocery store, come out to the car with groceries. It was the summer. I had a pocket T-shirt on, bent over to put the stuff in the car, thought my cell phone was going to fall out, grabbed my left chest. They saw it, called into their contact. Within minutes, a person come on, identified himself as David Miscavige, and said to them, listen, if it's his time to die, let him die. Don't intervene. Don't do anything.
Okay, here's what I don't understand about that scenario. If your cell phone is going to be falling out of your left chest pocket as you're bending over, you reach up quick, you grab it, you fix it, and then you move on. You're not hanging on to your chest like you're having a heart attack for, you know, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds. This is like a 10-second thing. How did they come up to the conclusion that you were having a heart attack?
Well, let me tell you something. These two guys are not the brightest, sharpest knife in the drawer, okay? I mean, look, they're getting paid $10,000 a week. Yeah. They spent it as soon as they got it. I mean, if you are in a position of affluence, what you do is you pay off all your bills first and don't get anything with future commitments on it. The one kid had five Camaros. What is this? They'd buy handguns like they were bags of peanuts. So
now, hold on. Is this in Jersey? Because, you know, someone owning five Camaros in Jersey, that's not a weird thing.
No. All right, no. They caught me. They spotted me in a town called Janesville, and the grocery store was Aldi's. By the way, all these things I'm telling you about, it goes into great detail in the book, including the escape.
Yeah.
The escape itself, Drew, I'm telling you something. Every time I read it, I say to myself, good Lord, did we actually do that?
But did you make a video about your escape? Did you video while you were driving out?
Of course not.
Okay, so the video of somebody driving out in the car, and it's supposed to be you narrating over it. You're telling me that that's probably not, A, it's not you videoing, and B, it's not your voiceover?
Well, let me ask you something. Would I have to prove to you that I'm not Santa Claus, or would you take my word for it? This is what we're talking about here. Yeah. I am telling you something. The people who are on that base literally have had their minds altered. This is a cult, my friend. You're not talking about a religion, in my estimation, and I think I'm entitled to an opinion because I was involved as a Scientologist for 42 years and as a C organization member for 26 and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've often said, and my litmus test for whether something is a cult is a little different than most people, but I'll go with it. I'll still stay with it. And it goes a little something like this. If you decide to leave an organization and they treat you like crap, it's a cult.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I'll join your club because this is what happened. I mean, listen, they also say that, you know, I could have left anytime I wanted to. It's It's fairy tales.
Okay, now
look
listen.
At all the people who have left, and they'd go after them.
You know. Whenever I got to be careful because, you know, I've learned over the years, it's really, really easy to look at someone else's belief system and laugh at it, and then what I tried to do was look at my own belief system. Now these days, my own belief system is in complete shambles, so I got nothing. But when I used to point fingers, you know, I used to be an evangelical pastor, and evangelicals are really good at pointing the finger and laughing at others. But when you take a good look at what your own belief system believes, there's some wacky stuff in all tribes. In every religious tribe, in every faith system, there's wacky stuff. So I want to be really careful not to just sort of, you know, laugh and write off. And I think you were pretty good, Ron, at the beginning, saying, look, there are some good things about this organization.
And right? I still believe that there are good things about it. But I'll tell you this, to try to sift out those things from what you have to go in order to be a member these days, you're not going to be able to do it, my friend.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just give you a little background. Where I live, it's about 15 minutes away from where they're planning on building the Canadian National Headquarters.
Right.
Big piece of property out in the country, small town politics, you know, you can see the setup coming a mile away.
Yeah.
Should I really give a holy grunt? Because some people, you know, that list of ex-Scientologists I talked to, a number of them said, don't worry about it. They don't have enough money. They're not going to be able to build it.
Well, okay. I don't think it's true that they don't have enough money, because the church itself, per person who investigated this thoroughly, has about $3.5 billion in assets. Okay. So you're not short of change if you get that much money.
Right.
But I think as time goes by and more people leave and more people are looking at the internet, that Scientology is dwindling, no matter what they say at these events and stuff. They had a report on the opening of this radio station in Los Angeles, and they put 1,000 chairs out, and then they had the gall to say 10,000 people were at the thing. I mean, you know.
I know. I saw that report. I thought that was kind of funny.
You know, and I'll tell you, as far as religion is concerned, I'm telling you, man, if people get the book, first of all, I think it should be on everybody's bucket list, because this is something that will proof you up against getting involved in something like this or getting involved.
Yeah.
But at the end, if you take my advice and spend the time and the effort to read some of these references, I am telling you, man, I think you're going to find something that's going to help you in life tremendously. I know this. I've achieved quite a few different things that I think are pretty good. And every time I achieve these, I use the modus operandi that they recommend in these books, which has to do with a universal mind, or what you would call God. And I'll tell you, no matter what religion you are, it isn't going to change it, but you might have a better understanding, from my viewpoint anyway, as to how this make this work to lead a better life.
All right, we are on the line here with Ron Miscavige. He's the father of David Miscavige, the leader of the Church of Scientology. He and his family joined Scientology back in 1970. He worked for the Sea Org for almost 27 of those years before leaving the church entirely in 2012. Here's, you know, this is the part I really like about your bio. He's a Marine veteran and professional musician who lives in Milwaukee. Dude, there's enough there for you and I to talk for an hour on. That's gold right there.
I know. I love the area, too. And I'll tell you this. When I was in Canada the few times, I've been to Edmonton, by the way, which is
I'm so sorry.
That's out of the way. Oh. And the guy driving me back from the airport was saying, how was your trip, Ron? And he kept on saying this. And I thought, what are you trying to do to me, man? But I just realized it's something that people say up there, you know? And just, but friendly. Everybody was friendly that I dealt with. And I know this. You got the hockey players.
Yes, we do. You know, you've just won over the entire audience. Well done in one statement. That's good. Look, all I want to know is, being from Milwaukee, did you ever meet Laverne and Shirley?
No. Okay. That's a great question, though. But I'll tell you what. Leah Remini happens to be a good friend of mine. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I knew that you guys had met and talked, and you know, she was quite open about opening up her place for you guys. So I knew there was a real camaraderie there.
Yeah, and what it was is we used to go to Los Angeles and put on a show in the summertime for the glitterati of Hollywood. And I met her there many years ago. And for some reason, we just hit it off. And her husband, great guy, a great singer. And we just happened to hit it off. And then when I left, she reached out to me and said, hey, listen, if you need any help or you need a place to stay, you can stay with us.
Yeah.
She's a very wonderful person.
I think both you guys are pretty streetwise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I will tell you that.
Yeah.
I know this. The Marine Corps, that first 10 weeks, first night in the Marine Corps, I said to myself, and I'm not going to use my profanity because I did get my doctorate degree in profanity in the United States Marines. I said, this is the worst blank mistake I've ever made in my life. 10 weeks later, Drew, I said to myself, I can make myself do anything. And that discipline that I got in that short 10 weeks has helped me my entire life. And thank God for the United States Marines. First one in and the last one's out.
Okay, how many children do you have?
Four children.
Ronnie, David, and Denise. David and Denise are the twins. Lori.
And Lori.
Yeah. And how many of them are Scientologists?
They're all Scientologists, except for Ronnie, Denise, and Lori, and all of their children, and their great-grandchildren. None of them talk to me. Ronnie talks to me, and my granddaughter, Jenna, and her two kids talked to me.
So did Ronnie ever get in, or he never signed up?
No, he was in for many years, but he left in the 90s.
Is there anything about your son, David Miscavige, is there anything about him that you're actually proud about when it comes to him being the leader of Scientology?
Let me tell you this, my friend.
Yeah.
David is a very brilliant person, and he, even as a kid, had a great sense of humor, very smart. I mean, when he was in elementary school, him and this other kid were picked as the two smartest kids in that school and went to a teacher's convention where they questioned them and they showed them off as a product of that elementary school. And we had a lot of good times together. And I'll tell you this, I think no matter what David would have done, he would have done it well and he would have succeeded in it. He happened to pick this, and because of his acquisition of so much power, I think that's what turned him into a person that he was not when he was younger. And I'm sure you know this, but the guy who said it was a guy by the name of Lord Acton, member of British Parliament in the 1800s, early 1900s. He said, power has a tendency to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I think this is what's happened to David. You get a taste of that, and it's like a drug. And now he's surrounded by a coterie of people who just keep him pumped up all day, where he can do no wrong, say no wrong, and he lives the high life. And
Ron, what did he learn from you?
Probably to work.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you, because when they were little, if I was going to change the oil in the car, David and Ronnie would be out there helping me. If I was going to do some, you know, what you call government projects around the house, all of our kids helped. I mean, I remember painting the kitchen till like 1 o'clock in the morning. All of the kids helped. I built a recreation room on the back of the house. All of them did that. They all had chores around the house, and they realized in order to get along in life, you have to produce something where you can exchange with somebody else for wherewithal. And I think that was the thing that they got from me.
Okay. Look, this is obviously a bit of a lead into David's anger management problems, because everybody I've talked to has said that he loses his nut. You know, he kind of cuts loose a little bit with the anger once in a while. Do you think he got that from you? Because people have said to you, well, you know, your girls accused you of abusing them and your ex-wife, and other people have said this, that, and the other, and you've owned a few things yourself. So do you think your son learned the anger stuff from you? Is that fair or is that unfair?
No, that's a fair question, and I'll give you the answer. The answer is no. And I'm going to tell you, first of all, these things that they're saying about me are so horrendous and exaggerated. It's true. And I go over this in an entire chapter in a book, that my wife and I had a very contentious marriage for a lot of years until we got in Scientology. And there would be violence where we'd have fights. I don't make any excuses for that. And I did it. What am I going to say? I always try to be better. And I'm married to my current wife. It'll be 26 years. It never even occurred to me to have that type of violence in our lives.
No.
But my daughters, aren't that way. My other son, Ronnie, isn't that way. So, no, everybody is dealt a hand. How you play those cards is up to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is true that, you know, I probably, not probably, I mean, you know, I wouldn't back off from somebody who told me this or that and it wasn't true. I'd confront them on it. They did get confronting people from me. And, of course, my first wife was that way, too. I will say that. You don't back off, but you confront people, but you try to handle it with communication. Yeah. And that'll work a good 100% of the time.
You know, it strikes me as weird that Scientology seems to preach a way to total freedom, and yet they all seem to be trapped by paranoia, revenge, you know, smear campaigns. Like, if you spend that much effort trying to control the message, they preach a way to total freedom, and yet the whole thing reeks of control. It just seems so ironic to me.
Well, you said a mouthful. I don't know what I can add to that, because it is true. If what I was saying was a lie, I mean, people who tell lies, it'll die on the vine.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you come out with the whole campaign and saying things about me that are so horrendous, it's just, it blows me away that they could stoop that low. It's like a subhuman type of statements they're making. And if what I have to say is not true, why even bother with me?
Were you surprised, Ron, about anything else that kind of came out of you while you were sitting down and writing the book and you and Dan Kuhn working together? Did stuff come out of you that you were sort of surprised about?
Well, when I decided to write the book was in October of 2014, when I went to see my daughters, and my daughter Denise's husband came to the door, didn't want to talk to me, didn't want me to let me see Denise. And after about 20 minutes of tap dancing, I said, "Hey, Jerry, what does this mean? You're through with this?" And he said, "Ron, Denise and I are through with you and Becky forever." That's when I decided to write the book.
Because of this stupid disconnection policy.
Exactly right. Now, when I sat down to write the book, my fingers couldn't keep up with my thoughts. I couldn't type as fast as I could get my mind to put it down. Then I tried voice to text, which you spend 90% of your time correcting words. I mean, it's ludicrous. So I figured, here's what I'm going to do. Dan Kuhn is a good friend of mine. He flew over from Sweden, and we sat down at the table I'm sitting at right now, talking to you on my computer, and I told the entire story. And we spent hours and hours and hours every day, and he just sat there and recorded it on the tape recorder, not a tape recorder, but the digital recorder.
Yeah.
And I told the entire book in about maybe 6 days.
Wow.
That's how it was written. And, of course, then it goes into smoothing out things and maybe taking out this. Or, you know, then you have your legal points. You have to sit, with an attorney, we spent 6 weeks going over every statement in the book and making sure that it wasn't litigious. And then the copy editing and copywriting, it all took a bunch of time. And I think the book itself is a very even-handed look at that religion. And I have trouble getting the word religion out of my mouth when I refer to Scientology these days.
I do, too. That's interesting.
Drew, let me tell you something. I was raised a Catholic, okay? And I remember going to confession when I was a little kid. And there was a priest there who was from Poland, and he probably could understand about one-third of what I was saying. So I'd go in the confessional booth and say, "Father, bless me. It's been 2 weeks since my last confession, and the following are my sins." And I'd give my sins. And then he would say, "Well, that's nice. Say five Our Fathers and five Hail Marys, and you're forgiven." And I'd walk out, and I'd say those prayers. And, you know, I felt good. So that religion was a bit of a place where I could find some succor to the sufferings of life.
Right.
That priest didn't have a digital recorder recording my voice and a video camera aimed at my face, and then said to me at the end, "Yes, Ranusz," which is my name in Polish, I guess. But he didn't say, "Yes, you're forgiven. But if you ever come out against us, we're going to use these things against you."
That is the thing, man. You know, even when I was invited to L. Ron's, was it 150th birthday party a few years ago?
Yeah.
They had a big celebration down in Toronto, and the president, lovely lady, I mean, she doesn't return my calls anymore because I think I've interviewed so many ex-Scientologists, she She's not allowed to talk to me. I don't know. But I'd still love to have her on the show. Yvette Shank, the president of Scientology Canada. I had a lovely time. I was introduced to important people who I can't remember because obviously they weren't that important. And it was kind of weird standing up and sitting down and applauding and up and down and up and down and the big celebration and hoo-ha. And I didn't kind of get it. But I remember her saying, you can be any religion. This is not a religion. You can be any religion. There's a Christian over there. There's a Buddhist guy over there. And there's this over here. It doesn't matter what religion you are. You can be a Scientologist. And I wonder if the whole, we got to be called a religion, is all about the tax break.
Well, yeah, I do think it is.
Or control, or institutional control. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, and this idea that you can be any religion and still be a Scientologist, from my viewpoint, it simply isn't true.
Really?
It simply isn't true.
Huh.
But I will tell you this, and if people want to take the time to read these references and really understand what they're saying, you could follow many of these precepts and still be, you know, a Lutheran, Episcopalian, or whatever. It will not impinge on your personal belief on what you think or feel that God is, or any dogma that you may subscribe to in your religion.
Yeah.
But you will get a better understanding of life from reading these. And I'll tell you, because it's past 75 years, you can't really copyright these. Some of these you can get for 99 cents. You can download them. Some for nothing. But I'll tell you this, Drew. It's the old story. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. It's going to take some effort to get these and read them and understand them in order to benefit from them. Listen, it's not like I'm selling these books to try to make a buck on them,
yeah,
but I'm giving you good advice,
yeah,
and it is real good advice. The book itself, I can tell you this, you'll benefit greatly from reading it, and if you buy it just out of curiosity, you want to find out about Scientology, I think you're going to get benefits that are unexpected to you, because it will give you a state of mind where you yourself would not get trapped in something like that I was in.
What do you miss?
Some of the people, because I'll tell you right now, the rank and file, the guys, the musicians that I know, even though right now a lot of them are saying things about me that they're doing it with guns pointed at their head. For God's sake, I mean, it just, that friendship that we had over all these years and we worked hard together and produced nice things, those are the things that I miss. But I have new friends here. I sat in as a guest artist with the Dixieland Band in 2013. And out of that, I play in about four different bands here.
Good for you.
One in Northern Illinois. Pardon me?
Good for you. Good for you.
I enjoy it. That's... And I know how to play. So because of that, I get gigs.
Well, I bet you don't miss your mail being read, incoming and out. You don't miss people listening to your phone calls. You don't miss. Now, hold on. Did you get a crushing workload put on you? I mean, you're David Miscavige's dad. They would take it easy on you, wouldn't they?
No, I had the same. Listen, there was a point when I first came in, when I first arrived at the Sea Org, maybe a couple of weeks I was in, and I was walking out of the music studio, and I looked to my left, and I saw David, and I yelled out, "Hey, Dave." And he was walking with his entourage, which was about three or four people. And he looked at me and he gave me a stare. And I realized I'm not his father on this place. I'm another staff member.
Wow. Were you supposed to call him, "Hey, COB?
I called him sir. And he would call me Ron. He wouldn't call me dad.
That's just.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, look, I'm looking at the time here. You have just given us enormous, enormous amount of time. Thank you.
I appreciate you letting me talk because it's dear to my heart to be able to get this out to a lot of people so they can read and understand how you can get involved in something like this. You'll see when you read the book that there's a certain thing that you do that you yourself build your own mental prison, and you know, you trap yourself. It's wild the way it happens, but.
Well,
you know, I'm not going to tell you the whole story in a 30-minute interview.
No. Well, listen, Ron, I really hope. Now, you tell me if this is fair or not. Maybe kind of a weird way to end this interview, but my hope is that Lori and Denise, whether they stay in Scientology or not, come to a point where they realize that you, as part of their lives, their kids' life, your grandkids, some great-grandkids you haven't even met yet, Like, that's the biggest thing, man. That is just the biggest thing. And if you guys need to go to counseling, go to counseling. And if you guys need to work through stuff, you work through stuff. You know, that's what I hope. I hope whether they stay in it or not, I hope that's what happens.
I think, and I appreciate you saying that, Drew, but I think if I could sit down with them and my grandchildren, we could, sitting at a table, keep on talking till we sorted out everything and we would be back together as a family. Because I'm going to tell you something. The reason I wrote this book, and it is called
Ruthless
Scientology, My Son David Miscavige and Me. The reason I wrote that is for that disconnection policy that I would like to see dropped and not applied to anybody in that church. And these people who have been, kids have been taken away, or brothers and sisters not talking to each other, and friends get back together and just have the relationship that they had before it was applied to them, because it's the worst thing you can do to a person, take their family away. Well, and listen, I'm 80 years old, man. It's not like I'm 28 or 50 or something like that. For God's sake, man.
Yeah. No, and here's the thing. Let's say you are a jerk. Let's say you're an abusive, manipulative, power-hungry jerk. Yeah. The amount of people that I've interviewed who have had the same disconnection stuff go down in their family, and they are these meek, timid, beautiful souls, there's enough of those people to get me to believe that this disconnection stuff is legit. You know, I mean, come on, there's a billboard somewhere I saw, and maybe it was the 2020 thing, where there's somebody said to their kids, hey, you know, I'm here, contact me, reach out to me. It was a whole billboard that somebody put up. Where was that, by the way?
It's in Los Angeles. Phil and Willie Jones put it up because their daughter and their son is in a C organization and is disconnected from them. But I'm going to step back to one thing what you said. Let's say I was a jerk, an abusive guy, and all these things, right? Okay, now, on my 70th birthday, my kids chipped in and bought me a car. On my 75th birthday, my daughters sent me 75 gifts. In 2005, I think it was, Lori went to see David and said, listen, if Dad can't come to see us, we want to visit him. So they came to Los Angeles and spent, I think it was 4 days with me and Becky, my wife, and I just cooked meals. We hung out together, watched some videos, and just enjoyed each other's company. If I was this abusive jerk, I don't know, do these two things make sense, what I just said?
No. No, because what they're accusing you of is stuff that happened before all that. And so really the only thing that is kind of twigging in my mind is this all comes down to the book?
Totally. Listen. Up to the point I left.
Yeah.
I used to play at events. I played at Tom Cruise's birthday party on the ship, for God's sake. Hmm. I took Katie Holmes into the studio, the Mad Hatter studio, for her to record a song for Tom. And this was my relationship with everybody. Now that I've left, because I write a book exposing these things, I now turn into something else. That's what's happened.
Yeah.
And they want to character assassinate me so nobody will believe what I wrote in the book. That's exactly how it goes.
Okay. All right. Obviously, you and I could talk for a long time. Good night. So Ruthless tries to make sense of David Miscavige's embrace of what the church calls disconnection, shunning family members who leave or criticize the church, and what his leadership means for its members and for the future of Scientology itself. Ron Miscavige, of course, is who we've been chatting with, the author of Ruthless, and he's arguing that the influence his son wields over so many people is toxic, and under his son's leadership, a relatively benign, if flawed and controversial, philosophical movement has transformed into what his father ultimately considers an emotionally damaging organization that has ripped families apart, including his own.
There's so many people that's come out against Scientology and told stories. Is everybody lying, and the only people that are telling the truth is the church?
Well, if they are truth-filled, then what I have discovered is that light pierces darkness. Light does not bring darkness. And so the amount of darkness that these guys have brought onto other people's lives does not give a good indicator that they're light.
I know.
So, again, thank you for pouring your guts out. Thank you for this book and your vulnerability. I mean, you could have just put your head in the sand and be done with it.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something, man. I'm a United States Marine. We do not run from people like that, okay?
No, no. Ron Miscavige, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, listen, I appreciate you having me on, and you're a fair-minded individual, which I like. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.